I'm going to start this week's programme with a story said to have influenced our great life all her life. It concerns a little girl who's sent into the forest by her stepmother. When the girl reaches a house in the forest, she's asked whether she wants to enter via the gold door or the tar door. Modestly, our heroine chooses the tar door and is promptly showered with gold. But when her stepmother sees the girl returning with this gold, she sends her own daughter back to the house. This girl chooses the gold door and is promptly showered with tar. Our guest today will recognise the story and its significance. Eleanor Bron's career began with satire and then moved into stage, film and television. She was in Peter Cook's Establishment Club, appeared alongside the Beatles in Help. Her name is said to have inspired Paul McCartney's Eleanor Rigby. And on television has appeared in Yes Minister, Doctor Who, Absolutely Fabulous, and so the list goes on. Eleanor, none of this from your life, all so much fun, prepares us for the life you've chosen to champion, something sadder, stranger, more clouded and ambiguous, perhaps even tragic, and very much in a minor key. Tell us about your great life, Simone Weil.
Simone Weil, well, it's lovely to know how correctly to pronounce her, because I used to be unsure when I mentioned her name because people didn't respond, so I thought perhaps it was pronounced in the German way, Weil. But that didn't produce any response either, so I realised that people just didn't know who she was. I was introduced to her when I was at Cambridge by John Bird. I think he gave me one of her books, On Science, Necessity and the Love of God, which I have never really opened, put off by the title. But there's another one called Gravity and Grace, which is a series of short paragraphs, and each one was very thought-provoking. So I became fascinated by that, and then as time went on, I was interested by her life, and then even more interested by the fact that her life and her philosophy were one and the same, that she's one of those very rare people who practiced what she'd thought out.
What about that story of the little girl and the gold and the tar? Do you see that as central to the way Simone Weil thought?
Well, I do, and as you read it just now, I think because what Simone Weil seems to me to have been able to do all her life was to remain with her first impulses in thought, so that whereas most of us, we're taught how to behave and not to lie and to do good to others, then as we grow up, we find that actually that doesn't really work, certainly not all the time. But Simone Weil never shook off that childlike, simple approach to the basic goodness of life. The second response of the stepmother, whoever it was that sent the daughter to get covered in tar, is the compromised person, it seems to me, the person who tries to be cleverer than others.
She was an entirely uncompromised person, wasn't she?
That's one reason why I've chosen her, is it seems to me that... And she didn't want other people to do it. She wasn't a moralising person in that way, but she thought deep and hard about morals and how to behave.
With us to help with the story of Simone Weil, political activist, mystic, thinker and sort of latter-day saint, we have the poet Graham Davies, who based both his doctorate and his first novel, Everything Must Change, on her life. Graham, for the benefit of lots of us who don't know much about her, could you just sketch out in brutal detail that life?
Certainly. Well, Simone Weil was born in 1909 to comfortable, middle-class Jewish parents in Paris. They were not practising Jews, they were not observant in any way, but she was, as Ellen said, outstandingly intelligent right from the earliest age, and also showed this very precocious desire for self-abnegation. She'd refuse even the simplest normal domestic luxuries and comforts right from the earliest age.
There's a story that at the age of three she refused a ring from her cousin, saying, "I don't like luxury."
That's right, and she showed this penchant for self-sacrifice and for living for others, and what saved her really from becoming rather preachy and overbearing, which one would think that kind of behaviour would tend towards, is the fact that she never expected that of other people. She had a lifelong compassion for the oppressed, and she tried to live like a worker, lived on unemployed workers' wages, gave up her teaching positions to work in factories, and despite her lifelong involvement with politics of the left during that whole period of ferment in the interwar years, she found herself in the early years of the Second World War getting closer and closer to conservative politics and to Christianity. And the attempt to unite these disparate elements dominated the last few years of her life, during which she fled from Vichy France to London to join the Free French, from where she hoped to be sent on some kind of self-sacrificial mission into France. And really during this period, she did the greatest work of her life in terms of her writing, but also suffered a physical decline and was transferred to a sanatorium in Kent, in Ashford, where she died at the age of 34. And she's buried there in the new cemetery in Ashford.
I've seen her described as one of the most remarkable thinkers of the 20th century, and her story is pretty mind-blowing. Yet, before you brought her to my attention, I have to say I knew almost nothing about her. Why has this woman, her life and her work, passed people like me so much by?
I would say that she embodies what I think are the four fears that most people have about when they meet other people. She is highly intelligent, riddled with goodness. She is a woman, and she is different. People, when they encounter someone like that, don't know what to do, so they push it to one side. I'm not sort of preaching feminism or anything, but it is a fact of life, and that a lot of the names that she was called and so on are very just sort of casual prejudice that we encounter.
Her mother wrote in 1914, "I do my best to encourage in Simone not the simpering graces of a little girl, but the forthrightness of a boy, even if this must at times seem rude." She herself spoke later of the misfortune of being born a woman. Rather forbidding attitude from her mother.
I rather admire it. Yes, I think. But it obviously did contribute to getting her into quite a lot of trouble. And maybe her mother regretted it afterwards, because the trouble that Simone brought on herself, of course, eventually was visited on her mother in many sad ways.
She was just eight when the Russian Revolution took place, and it seems to have made a terrific impression on her, didn't it, Graham?
Yeah, she described herself really as quite a small child, as a Bolshevik, and which must have been quite disconcerting for her her teachers.
And she gave her chocolate rations to a soldier.
She did. She and her brother adopted a soldier. There was a programme at the time whereby soldiers who were orphans and had no one to send them comfort at the front were adopted by well-wishers, and she and her brother adopted a soldier. And there's a very touching story in which the soldier actually came to visit the family on leave, and he and Simone would walk hand in hand in the garden talking about goodness knows what. But this is a very small child and a soldier back from the Western Front in the First World War. And of course this poor soldier was killed shortly afterwards. But this compassion for the suffering and for people, you know, from different backgrounds was something that was there from the earliest age.
I want to have a look at her time. She spent a long time being a worker in French factories, various factories in Paris. And perhaps you, Eleanor, would read this from her diary.
Afternoon, stamping press. Pieces very difficult to position at 56 centimes per hundred, 600 from 2:30 to 5:15. Half an hour to reset the machine, which was out of adjustment because I'd left a piece in the tool. Tired and fed up. Feeling of having been a free being for 24 hours on Sunday, and of having to readjust to slavery. Disgust at being forced to strain and exhaust myself, with the certainty of being bawled out either for being slow or for botching, for the sake of these 56 centimes. There are quite a lot of accounts of her working at these machines.
Why is she doing it?
Well, she wants to know what people are going through, and she certainly finds out, and she discovers that the condition of a great deal of mankind is what she calls slavery, and that we are all slaves. The need to keep up speed and produce bits of machinery, and the same in the fields. And of course, it was doubly difficult for her because she was actually a very clumsy person. There's this terrible time when she went to fight in the Civil War, and the first thing she did while helping to cook was to pour boiling oil on herself and had to be invalided out immediately. It's very moving. There's a wonderful passage too where she has to work in front of the furnaces and her face is all hot and her arms are covered with scorch marks, and she catches the eye of a young worker there, and he gives her what she calls a fraternal smile, and she said it went to my heart and warmed me so much. And it is that sense that she has of how to relate to people. And what is, I thought, most interesting is her discovery of the brutalising, the dehumanisation of people who have to work in such a way that they can't even daydream. You know, the work is automatic, but it's not, you can't just do it automatically. It's mindless, but you have to concentrate.
And I think we have to remember how new those circumstances were. That kind of factory labour, it wasn't anything that people were familiar with. And she was looking on this as a kind of new area, not of research that would make it too kind of abstract a concept, but it was a new area of human experience which was becoming so widespread with the division of labour in factories of the time, that she felt it was a moral responsibility to get involved and find out what was increasingly affecting the lives of so many of her fellow citizens.
Well, she'd be pleased, wouldn't she, Eleanor, at the increasing computerisation of manufacture these days, that a lot of that brutal...
That's very interesting. I don't know whether she would, because I think she would be worried by what's happening to society in terms of becoming more materialistic. Perhaps every society says that they're becoming more materialistic, but it does really feel like that. And also a remoteness that has set in, so that we're all on our mobile phones talking to people who are not there and ignoring the people who are there. I think that would have distressed her very much indeed.
Here's something her mother wrote when Simone was just 6 years old. She is indomitable, impossible to control, with an indescribable stubbornness that neither I nor her father can make a dent in. She stands up to us with an aplomb and assurance that are by now rather comic. My husband can't keep from bursting into laughter in the middle of these scenes, but that, if continued, will be distressing. Eleanor, do you see anything of yourself in that small child?
I'm pretty contrary, goodness knows. Her behaviour is described very often as willful, but I think it should be spelt with two L's, because a lot of what she achieved, and people thought was kind of masochistic, was achieved through tremendous self-discipline and will. I mean, she had suffered all her life from terrible migraines. She just went on and did what she had felt she had to do. So she had an extraordinary sense of duty. And I certainly don't have that kind of self-discipline. I've got the contrariness still.
Maybe not, but I sense that in my opening CV for you, it made you sound all rather light and fluffy, because all the things you'd been doing that I listed had been light and fluffy. But I can't think that either your career or your life has been all light and fluffy.
No, not at all. But I think it's now acknowledged that comedians are the saddest people in the world. And it is the famous phrase, which is, I think, said by Walpole and by Beaumarchais, I hasten to laugh about it for fear that I may be forced to cry.
This is BBC Radio 4, and you're listening to The Great Life of Simone Weil, chosen by Eleanor Bron. Our expert here is the poet Graham Davies. Simone Weil's short life encompassed three great events: the Depression, the Spanish Civil War, and the Second World War, and I want to talk about all of them in the second half of the programme. First, though, this thought occurs. She was clearly brilliant, but also somewhat willful, or willful, as you put it, Eleanor, and somewhat eccentric. She seems both troubled and troubling. What was it about her, given that at this point she'd published nothing, that seemed to grab and hold attention, that made people notice her?
I imagine it was her sincerity. She clearly didn't care what they thought about her, but she meant what she said, and I think that, again, is a very rare thing.
Yes, and the way she tried to unify her thought and her action, and I think this is really one of the most striking things about her, and one of the things which her contemporaries remember most fully, is the fact that principles meant nothing to her unless they were put into action in whatever that might have meant, whether it was becoming a factory labourer or giving away her rations to the poor, or, in fact, activism, of course, on behalf of all kinds of oppressed groups.
Trotsky used to lodge with her, didn't he, when he came to Paris?
He did. When he was in Paris as an exile and under the disfavour of the Soviet regime, yes, he lodged with her parents, and Simone had a conversation with him, which we have the benefit of a contemporaneous note of hers, which she took immediately afterwards, and they argued quite violently, and in fact I think it ended with Trotsky stumping up the stairs and saying, "What's wrong with you? Are you a member of the Salvation Army?"
That's right. I think she took him to task over the Kronstadt mutiny.
I mean, what is rather wonderful too about her, I think, is that she dismissed communism and fascism. She said they arrive at the same point, which is a very good point to make, I think.
And she saw through the USSR much earlier than most of the left in Europe did.
Yes, much, much earlier.
Much earlier. And I think she saw no obligation to toe any kind of party line. And even though she would often begin by idealising some group which she saw as being progressive in some ways, if she saw any hypocrisy there or any compromise, then she would call that out and name it for what it was. As you say, would do that with communism and fascism alike.
What impresses me more than anything about her is this rigid, dogmatic, but really hugely admirable determination to eliminate the gap between belief and action.
Yes.
Not to do things in which she didn't believe.
Yes.
But I've wondered whether, if one takes that too far, perhaps it becomes then hard to believe things that one isn't prepared to do, and perhaps a little hypocrisy, a little setting of the mind free, rather than thinking whatever it is that I conclude I must now put into action in my own life, might actually be philosophically liberating, might have been for her.
I don't think she was a hypocrite. I think she may have, you know, a lot of people accuse her of being hypocritical, that she would live like a worker, and she would only live on the equivalent of unemployment benefit and give the rest of her money to the miners' strike. And they said, yes, but she had her parents there and she could always escape. But she didn't escape, actually. She stuck it out. Mm. And not for its own sake. There's one point where she says, I believe in the value of suffering so long as one makes every legitimate effort to avoid it. Well, that's really thorough.
But she didn't, did she, make every legitimate... She seemed to throw herself straight into situations where she'd suffer.
She did, and there is a pattern in her life of seeking out situations where she would be made to suffer. But I think Ellen is absolutely right to note the fact that she didn't enjoy the suffering.
No. Oh, there's another thing that she says in a letter to someone. She said, the suffering all over the world obsesses and overwhelms me to the point of annihilating my faculties. And the only way I can revive them and release myself from the obsession is by getting for myself a large share of danger and hardship. She simply couldn't sit by and watch other people suffer. We all learn to do that. And we salve our consciences with contributions to this and little efforts for that. But she didn't do that. She didn't make any salving of herself.
She tried to throw herself into the Spanish Civil War.
She did. She saw that as a moral duty. She felt she couldn't stand by. So off she went to Spain to join the anarchist militia, because in those days, of course, with the situation in the Spanish Civil War, you could choose which flavour of militia you wanted to join, and that was the one that she joined. And 3 weeks there, and as Eleanor says, a cooking accident, and she was invalided out.
Which probably saved her life, because apparently all the women in her brigade were killed.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
But you saw how both sides behaved, that war made them all murderers, and you have to fight anything that brings death about.
I'd like to talk about the conversion. Well, not quite the conversion to Christianity, but the being drawn towards Christianity. What happened? How did it start, Eleanor?
Well, it's pretty baffling to me. I'm also a product of a fairly unobservant Jewish family. There is mysticism within Judaism, but it's not the foremost thrust of Judaism, which is a very pragmatic religion. And I think she wanted to answer questions, and that probing nature of hers and her intellect led her to keep questioning. Also, I think she found that Judaism is also a very violent God. The God of the Jews is always waxing very wroth, and she doesn't like that, and there's a lot of slaughter going on.
It was in a chapel in Assisi that she first...
That's right. It's after her Civil War experiences, when she was on some of her recuperative journeys, which seem so ironic as they were. They seem quite luxurious in contrast with her work in trying to immerse herself in the working classes. It was on those journeys that she started to have these mystical experiences where she felt suddenly that there was some power beyond herself, which she identified with the Christian God, because she was experiencing this in Catholic religious buildings. And this really determined the course of perhaps the last third of her life, and certainly the rest of her life.
I'm just wondering whether both of you are overlooking the extent to which the places she ended up in because of the strength with which she had rejected something else. She ended up being a worker because she'd rejected her bourgeois upbringing and society. I wonder if she was rejecting Judaism, and that was one of the reasons for Christianity.
I don't really feel that she was so imbued with Judaism. I think I probably have much stronger sense of Judaism.
But you didn't like Judaism.
No, I can understand that for those reasons, you know, that he is an angry, the father, you know, first of all, there's this great father figure, and he's always cross with you. I mean, we can go into other explanations, you know. But also, she did have, and again, I can sympathise with it because I'm very contrary, she had felt the need always to examine the other side. I mean, I have my favourite saying for myself is the opposite is also true, or very possibly. And I think she also always wanted to examine the other side.
Here's a clip from her biographer, David McClellan, which explains something about how she changed. The clip goes back really a little to an earlier point in her life.
If you look at a photograph on some of the books about her, 12 years old, she looks a beautiful young woman, absolutely gorgeous, you know. But the other photographs of her, when she's into her 30s, she looks haggard, you know. This is partly because of her ascetic lifestyle, I think, which obviously had a strong impact upon her health. She suffered from migraines. And I think, of course, it's slightly speculative, but I think that sort of suffering, you know, not always self-induced at all, must have contributed to some extent towards her view of spirituality and about the kinds of things that were important in life.
We'll talk more about her health and her physical condition in a moment, but first the Second World War. How did this impact upon her, Graham?
Well, obviously this was a trauma for her. She'd felt that she was complicit in the circumstances, the political circumstances of pre-war France, and that they hadn't been sufficiently assertive in the face of German expansionism. And, of course, it was a huge existential problem for someone who was Jewish in a Nazi-occupied country. So she and her parents, after the period of the Phony War, they fled, literally without even returning to their flat to collect their belongings. They fled and established themselves in the Marseille area, which was really a magnet for people who were trying to escape France via the port there. And they'd intended, of course, to get out as quickly as they could. Her brother did manage to get out fairly quickly, but in fact ended up staying there for 2 years. They had visa problems in getting out, and it's during those 2 years of enforced staying in the Marseille area that really she did some of the greatest thinking and writing of her life, in the company of a circle of Catholic intellectuals in search of whom she went while she was there.
She met two particular priests, I think, who made a great impact, and she on them.
Well, there was Perrin, is it? And Thibon was a farmer, I think.
Yes, he was, and he was a friend of Perrin. They were a very devout Catholic layman, yes.
Yeah.
And really, it's in that relationship with Thibon in particular that really I found the greatest emotional connection when I was reading Simone's life, because he was, of course, a right-winger. He was a conservative Catholic landowner. He wasn't a big landowner, but he certainly represented that kind of class and was a spokesman for it. And they discovered, despite their immense political differences, they discovered this very precious friendship, and she entrusted her notebooks to him, and he then edited them after the war.
And is, I imagine, more than any other human being responsible for the growth of her reputation after her death.
And getting everything published, yes. And Camus also was a great promoter of her.
What took her to London?
Well, really, it was her desperate desire to unite herself with wherever suffering was happening, particularly with her own country. And she was desperate to throw herself into the resistance struggle, particularly desperate to promote a rather strange project, which was to set up a team of frontline nurses.
Oh, this is the business of parachuting nurses into the
Yes, yes. She wanted to set up these frontline nurses. Their main object seems to be really to been to get themselves killed, and became terribly dejected when the Free French wouldn't buy it.
She didn't seem to get very far with General de Gaulle and the Free French.
No, General de Gaulle thought she was crazy, I think. and I mean, in fact, it does sound like a rather absurd scheme, and one can hardly bear the thought of her with a parachute cord trying to pull the cord. But clearly also she was very distressed that they only wanted her to write.
Yes.
And that's all they wanted to use her for, which, of course, from their point of view, is very sensible.
They wanted her to help writing the French Constitution, and she immediately wanted to add alongside the rights of human beings to have their physical needs satisfied, their rights to have their spiritual needs satisfied.
Yes, but she also, I think, at some point wrote something which is a draft of human obligations, and I think that's one of the interesting elements of her thought, is that she quite quickly was on to something which is current now, which is how much are we owed and how much do we owe, and she made that distinction very early on.
Eleanor, I know this is a desperately touchy subject, but did she starve herself to death?
I don't think she did. I mean, I don't think that was a deliberate thing. I think that she lost interest. I actually was not very well about 6 months ago, and I lost my appetite, which has not happened to me before. You need a sort of energy. I think she was very low on energy, and of course I imagine that malnutrition in a way feeds upon itself. It's that you don't have the energy or the interest to eat. It didn't mean anything to her to eat. She didn't, I think, connect it with staying alive anymore.
I think it would be too much to say that she actually desired her own death or willingly or willfully brought it about, even when you look at this pattern of self-denial and this desire for self-sacrifice through her life.
But, I mean, she's only 33. She gets TB, mostly because she isn't eating. The doctor will have said to her, if you don't eat, you will die. And she didn't eat, and in the end she did die, and I can't completely ignore the possibility that there might have been an element of will here.
Well, it's sort of will to ignore something that doesn't interest her. I think if her mother had said it to her, she might have felt obliged to behave.
It's been awful for her mother.
Oh, terrible.
Don't you think it was cruel to her mother?
But I think that was one of the rare examples in her life of compromising, was how she did try and think of her parents. She wrote letters in which she did lie and say that she was fine, and so she wasn't entirely lacking with sensitivity to the feelings of other people, but her mind was very strong. And again, one of the reasons that I love her and what I know of her is she gives a place for intelligence. I think intelligence is underrated in this society, particularly. It's slightly better rated in France. But I think people always assume intelligence to be a malign thing. You know, people are afraid. They think they feel threatened by it, being different from other people and being a woman and so on. Those things are threatening.
The coroner's verdict was cardiac failure due to myocardial degeneration of the heart muscles due to starvation and pulmonary tuberculosis. The deceased did kill and slay herself by refusing to eat whilst the balance of her mind was disturbed. One could hope for a better epitaph than that.
Well, I reject that utterly. I think it's extraordinary to be able to live a life so consistently and so powerfully and so wholeheartedly, actually. I think that's magnificent.
One of her last letters to her parents, she said, I have a sort of inner certainty that there is within me a deposit of pure gold which must be handed out.
That's right. She was totally impersonal. She felt she had a gift. It's as if some people might feel they had a beautiful singing voice. She thought, I've got this mind which receives these ideas, and it's my duty to pass them on. That's pretty selfless. And she had to be very egotistical, perhaps, in order to stay with it.
My thanks to Eleanor Bron, who chose Simone Weil as her great life, and to our expert witness, Graham Davis. Goodbye.